Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Walter Isaacson tells us about the life of Socrates.
We don't know a whole lot about Socrates himself. He never wrote anything. Our knowledge comes mainly from people like Plato and Xenophon, who were his pupils.
A conversation with our new children's books editor, Pamela Paul.
If people don't read children's books, then they don't, generally speaking, grow up to become people who read grown-up books. And so that makes the world of children's literature, I think, phenomenally important.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. He's supposed to be the wisest man who ever lived, Socrates. But how much do we really know about him? There's a new ambitious biography called The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. It's by Bettany Hughes, and it's reviewed for us by a great biographer who knows a great deal about wise men, Walter Isaacson, who joins us from Washington. Hi, Walter.
Hey, how are you doing, Sam?
Okay, so in your review, you describe this, and the author does too, as a donut biography. What do you mean by that?
It's a wonderfully rich and tasty topic, but there's a hole right in the center where the main character is supposed to be. We don't know a whole lot about Socrates himself. He never wrote anything. Our knowledge comes mainly from people like Plato and Xenophon, who were his pupils. So what Bettany Hughes does brilliantly is give us that rich, tasty donut that outlines the hole where Socrates should be, so we can sort of see the shape of Socrates by knowing everything around him.
And that includes learning something about ancient Athens, is that right?
Learning something about ancient Athens, and what I love about this book is that it teaches you how to learn about ancient Athens. It brings you to various museums and places where there are relics or there's archives, so that you can see how a scholar would know what daily life was for Socrates.
And any surprises?
Well, the surprise is how much we end up knowing about Socrates. I mean, he's this slovenly, slightly hairy guy padding around barefoot, the son of a midwife and a stonemason. And by the end of the book, even though we don't have any direct communication from Socrates, I do get the feeling that I've met him in flesh and blood.
And Walter, does his, this will sound absurd, I'll say it anyway, his reputation hold up? Was this really the wisest of all ancient Athenians and one of the real pillars of modern human understanding?
Well, that's still a mystery in a way. He's like his mother, the midwife, which is he doesn't really give birth to a whole lot of new ideas, but he extracts them from other people. He's able to do it through what we now know as the Socratic method. He asks a lot of questions. So in my mind, I'm not one of the great classical scholars, but Plato gives us more of a foundation of direct ideas. But it's hard to separate Plato from Socrates because a lot of what Plato writes is the dialogues, the Socratic dialogues that he has with Socrates.
And if Socrates had a purpose or mission, what was it?
The examined life. His mantra was that the unexamined life is not worth living. And it sort of become the foundation of philosophy, that we can't just take things for granted. We can't assume it was all handed down by, you know, some word that's given to us. We have to always be questioning things. And if that's the great pillar of philosophy, then we do owe that to Socrates.
Thanks so much, Walter.
Sam, it's been great talking to you.
That's Walter Isaacson, the great biographer, who this week reviews The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Loyal listeners to this podcast, and I know there are some of you, will recognize the name Pamela Paul. She reviews frequently for the Book Review and has often been a guest in this program. But now she's a colleague. She is our new children's books editor, and she's here to talk about the job and her ideas about it in the world of children's literature. Welcome, Pamela.
Thanks.
Now, you are a much published author, written for many magazines, including the New York Times Magazine. You've got a nice life. Why would you want this particular job? What's so exciting about children's literature for you at this moment?
I think there's really two answers to that. One is what's perennially exciting about children's literature is that children's books are, you know, that is when we all become readers. If people don't read children's books, then they don't, generally speaking, grow up to become people who read grown-up books. And so that makes the world of children's literature, I think, phenomenally important. But what's exciting right now is that, in a way, the barriers between children's literature and grown-up literature are breaking down a bit. You know, whether it's because of things like comics and manga and graphic novels, which kind of operate, you know, operate in this middle ground, or there's a lot of crossover where YA is really appealing to a lot of adult readers. And so I think that it's a very exciting time in the world of children's books.
Now, Pamela, when you take over a job, as you've done, succeeding Julie Just, who became very well known in the world of children's books, the same is already happening to you. Do you hear from publishers? Are there people who want to meet you and have lunch with you? Does that raise questions? Does it help you understand who your audience is? What do you do in your first weeks in a job like this?
You do a lot of catch-up. I think that there are a lot of audiences for children's books. Obviously, the children themselves, but unless it's, you know, older children, they're generally, at least with the New York Times, not reading it for finding out what they should have read to them at bedtime. So you're mostly speaking to parents, but also to librarians, to teachers. And then there is, of course, the audience of the publishers and the many authors, illustrators, people that operate within the industry. And all of them, of course, have a very different view of what's important in a book, why a certain book should be reviewed. And so it is a constant balancing act. But my focus really is going to be on which children's books people are going to be talking about or should be talking about or thinking about. So that means both looking at books that we know are going to be huge because it's, you know, the author of, you know, three best-selling series, or because it's a book that is totally under the radar, but I think others within the industry think that this is a great book that should be discovered.
Now, you're a mom. You have three children. I imagine you read to them. Do you read to them now as a journalist and editor rather than as a mom, or do those things just kind of intersect?
I mean, well, I should say that they're perhaps should be considered in part employees of the New York Times because they're sort of an informal focus group, and they know now the difference between, you know, the books that they want to read or that mommy wants to read, and then the books that mommy would like their opinion of this particular book, which they now take very seriously and ask when I come home, you know, do you have any of the special important books for us to listen to and think about? So they're in on it.
Thanks a lot, Pamela.
Thank you.
That's Pamela Paul, who is the new children's books editor at the New York Times Book Review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, Donald Rumsfeld is back. He left his job as Secretary of Defense under a cloud of controversy, and now he's back on top of the nonfiction list with his memoir, Known and Unknown.
This is a big book. This is not just about Iraq, is that right?
It's about his whole career. I mean, obviously focused mainly on the invasion and occupation of Iraq. A lot of the reviewers, it's come in for some pretty harsh reviews, from across the political and literary spectrum. You know, Rumsfeld is known as a really tough bureaucratic infighter. And, you know, as with so many of these books, there's a lot of score settling here. There's been some rumblings from the Bush crowd about the way he represents the decisions that were made, who was to blame for things that went wrong in Iraq, etc. But speaking of Bush, his book is also still selling well, Decision Points. It's at number 5 this week, so he's not out of the game.
Yeah, he's got staying power as an author. Fiction, anything going on?
No great surprise at the top. James Patterson is still up there with his latest TikTok. He's been up there for 3 weeks now, but there's kind of an odd thing going on at number 2. There's a new vampire novel by Deborah Harkness called A Discovery of Witches. And Harkness is, not your typical vampire novelist. She's a very distinguished historian of science. Her last book was called The Jewel House. It was published by Yale University Press. It was about the scientific revolution in Elizabethan London. Needless to say, it was not a bestseller, but here she's sort of gone all A.S. Byatt or maybe all Sookie Stackhouse on us. It's about an American academic who is kind of looking around in the stacks at the Bodleian Library in Oxford and finds this sort of mysterious ancient manuscript called A Discovery of Witches, which is itself the title of a famous medieval manuscript, then kind of gets tangled up with vampires, including a 1,500-year-old, very sexy vampire who happens to have a great wine cellar. And interestingly, I was digging around in Harkness, in addition to being a very successful academic, is a quite popular wine blogger. So she's sort of wrapping all of her interests into one here and having a lot of success.
Maybe she's a new Umberto Eco.
Maybe. I'll have to see how her Italian is.
And what about our evolving and fascinating ebook list? What are we seeing there?
You know, I've been really curious since we rolled out our new ebooks bestseller list 3 weeks ago to see sort of how this was going to alter our perceptions of the book landscape. And interestingly, our graphics people did this amazing sort of special chart, which basically ranks the sales of all books, all new books published in the United States, regardless of whether they're fiction, nonfiction, published as ebooks, as selling as ebooks, selling as paperbacks, selling as hardcovers, whatever. Like, what are people really plopping their money down for? And, you know, unsurprisingly, James Patterson also at the top of this list. But down at number two, things start to get really weird. So the number two best-selling title in the United States in all formats this week is Lisa Gardner's Alone. And I sort of look at this and I'm thinking, what is this book? I haven't heard of it. I know Lisa Gardner is a sort of popular thriller writer. She's got a couple of books on the mass market paper list and on the ebooks list. And this is actually a book that was published back in 2005. It had a brief run on the hardcover list. Certainly didn't go to number two or number one. And now suddenly she's outselling Stieg Larsson, she's outselling Laura Hillenbrand, and she's outselling Donald Rumsfeld. And the big story here is price. This is selling entirely in ebook. Maybe some people are buying old mass market paperback editions, but according to data reported to the bestseller people, 100% of the sales are coming from ebooks, which are priced at 99 cents.
So that means then the number two selling book in America by the New York Times bestseller list data is a book being sold only as an ebook, at least as far as
basically, yeah, that's how people are buying it. And, then you start to wonder how much is this an apples to apples comparison? I mean, on the one hand, you got this book that cost 99 cents. Back when it was a hardcover, it cost $24. And then, you've got this 99-cent thriller up against, a book like, say, Rumsfeld, which, interestingly, the ebook edition of his memoir costs $19.99, which is actually more than the discounted hardback at, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. And he's only at number 10 on this giant mashup list. And a lot of that is the weakness of his ebook sales, or relative weakness of his ebook sales. He's only selling 23% of his books as ebooks.
So at least for now, it seems that to have a truly phenomenal, top-of-the-list bestseller, you have to carry your weight in ebooks too.
For the most part, yeah. And the thing that continues to amaze me is just what a big share of sales for new books, the big new books, come from ebooks. For most of the fiction bestsellers, it's in the 50 to 60% range. Nonfiction bestsellers, especially for kind of more serious, weighty stuff, it's usually more 30 or 40%, but still, that's huge. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that all unfolds and what this does to the market as a whole.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.